Hey, it's Friday. Let's have a cocktail with Anna Glavinsky.
Anna Glavinsky here, and delighted and honoured and excited to be joined on the line by Michael Armstrong, because we're going to be playing his new song, which I presume you haven't heard yet. It's called The Greatest Thing. And this guy is a pretty big deal. Hi, how you doing?
Hi, Anna. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, really good, thanks. I mean, you've had a number one top hit in the indie charts in the US, number 15 in the top 40. You're on a wave of success. What's it feel like?
Oh, well, that particular number one was in 2021. October, stayed number one for 4 weeks in September, October 2021. So at the time it felt, and still does, feels very, very justified, and makes me very happy. And this particular song that you're going to play actually sits currently at number 16 in the indie music charts. It went in this week. So number 16 there, and number 62, I think, in the top 100. So that's the debut. So hopefully it will rise and be as successful as the previous one was in 2021.
That must just be filling you with bubbles of excitement. Like, I can't really imagine what it must be like to be just sitting there and looking at these charts, looking at the numbers, and being like, I don't know, like gambling or watching a bingo outcome or something like that, being like, oh, come on, what's...
Well, it literally fills me with bubbles, because every time it goes up the chart, I open a bottle of champagne, so my wife and I, so yeah, literally fills me with bubbles. But no, it's really exciting. I get the chart news every Wednesday morning, well, during the night on Tuesday. I wake up to it on a Wednesday morning. It officially gets announced on a Friday in America. And it's good, America in particular, because their charts are done on radio play, not on sales or streams as it is these days. So it's slightly more lucrative when someone plays your record on the radio than when someone streams it. So I'm a very happy boy, yes.
Opening those champagne bottles. And you say that it feels justified. That's a brilliant word, because I believe that means that, you know, you put a lot of work into it. You feel like you're getting where you deserve to be. Tell us a bit about that.
Perhaps a little bit big-headed.
Not at all.
I don't know if anyone else can see me or they just listen to my voice. But
I can see you, but it's just you and me that can see. Everyone else is hearing.
I'm not an 18-year-old or even a 20-year-old or even a 30-year-old, dare I say. So when I say justified, I've been doing this for a very, very long time. So when the number one came in 2021, completely out of the blue, I have to say, I was not expecting it.
Really?
Yeah, it was just very fulfilling. And I say justified, that's probably not the right word, but I was just so proud for the people around me, my parents, my wife and children, my manager, all these people that have supported me and put up with me for many, many years. So I felt very proud and vilified, maybe is a better word, that I told you I could do it, that kind of thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Put all those down.
So justified but unexpected. That's quite a story. It makes you think that there's been a lot of work and time that's gone into a career as as a music maker. Can you tell us a little bit about your past and how you're the making of your music and the process of getting it out there and what your career has been like up until that point?
Sure, yeah. I've been in love with music and singing since I was a very young boy. I remember my parents had the Beatles' Blue and Red albums, the greatest hits albums, on cassette in those days. Many of your listeners might not remember them, but in their car. And so driving to school, or driving anywhere, we'd have the Beatles cassettes on, and I'd sing along with my brother. And as soon as I started to play the guitar, I guess when I was about 11, and as soon as I could play a few chords, I was writing songs. And they weren't very good then. Hopefully I've got better over time. And so when I was 18, or maybe a little bit later, I had a school band, that kind of thing. We did some good gigs in London. But it all kind of came to an end. Didn't quite get the record deal or anything like that we wanted. And I was being a bit of a hippie, sitting in my bedroom recording songs for a year or so. And my dad, as any good parent should do, and as I tell my children now, he said to me, okay, well, they were very supportive, my parents, of the music, but they said, while you're following this path, you should also probably get a proper job. And my dad ran a building company, a construction company in London. So I went to work with him And I have to say right at this point that I can't even put up a shelf. So when I say a building company, I wasn't out on the site building things because I'm absolutely useless at anything like that. So I was more on the management side. I was pricing jobs and doing the accounts. He kind of trained me to be an accountant.
I thought you were going to say that you were stood on the building site singing and motivating the other workers.
No, mainly driving around in a van singing and having fun. But yeah, and that kind of took over my life. I got married, I had three children, I got a mortgage, and this kind of filling job that was never meant to be my proper job kind of took over, and I ended up doing that for about 15 years. John Lennon said, "Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans." And I think that's a wonderful line, and it's exactly kind of what happens to a lot of people, I think. You know, you have these dreams and aspirations and you follow a certain path, and before you know it, here you are 40 years old with a family and things like that. And that's where I found myself. And at that particular time, I think I was about 38, 39, so it might have been a midlife crisis as well. During that whole period of 15 years, I continued to write songs and record them. I had a studio at home, but they never really went anywhere. And so my dad got ill and didn't want to carry on the business. The economic kind of downturn hit the UK. And so the work wasn't as bountiful as it was plentiful. And I met a lady called Lisa Davies who ran a promotions company and worked with all sorts of people. And I gave her a CD. I'd been hawking around these CDs for years and she finally listened to it. And so all these things kind of came together and I was met with a kind of crossroads. Do I carry on with this very successful building company? We made a real success of it, my dad and I, and it paid for my house here and all that kind of thing. I was living a good life. Do I stick with that, or do I throw it all away and decide at 40 years old to become a rock star, to follow my dreams? And of course I took the latter option. Of course I did. My wife and kids probably still haven't forgiven me, but there you go. I went for it. And that was 10 years ago. My debut album came out 10 years ago. And it's not been easy. But, I mean, just from that story alone, you can tell why when I got the number one in America, it was felt pretty, you know, justified. And thank God, maybe I did make the right call after all.
And how did you go about, you know, getting it out there, promoting it? You're with a record label or your producer, Lisa?
It was mad. When I did my first album 10 years ago, lots of people said to me, "Oh, this would work really well in America." And that means nothing. I think that's great. I'm sure. What do I do? What do I do? How does that work? You know, what can I do? And so I sat about one weekend. I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll get off my backside and I'll do something about it. So I will make a list of all the radio stations in America and contact them all. And so I started with Alabama, started at A, worked my way through the alphabet. And it was an exercise where I realized just how huge America is, because it took me about 6 months to compile all these emails.
My gosh.
Every radio station in every state. And I ended up with something like 20 or 30,000 emails. And I sent out my first song in a nice letter to go with it. Half of those emails pinged back because they didn't exist or had gone. And not a single person replied. And when the next single came out, I thought, well, I'll try it again because I've spent all this time making it. And
you've got the database now, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I got a response from some community station in Hawaii, I think it said. They said, "Aloha, we are playing your single." I thought, oh, well, fantastic. You know, at least someone's playing it. It wasn't a complete waste of time. And 3 years after that, my next album came out and I tried again. And I picked up a couple more, someone in Connecticut and someone in Detroit or something. And then when my third album came out in 2021, I sent out the single. It was a song called Each Other's Eyes, which was the opening track on that album. And I didn't realize, because no one contacted me, but a guy in New York started playing it on one of the stations there. And his colleagues heard it and they started playing it. And that spread to a different radio station. And eventually I was contacted by a promotions guy in New York who said, managed to track me down, said, "I'm hearing your song on the radio. I absolutely love it. Have you registered it for chart eligibility and all that kind of thing?" And of course I hadn't. I didn't know. I had no idea how to do that in America. And so he helped me do that. And I work in PR in England as well as being a musician. And now I do promote other artists.
Right.
And so for him to promote a song in America, it's really expensive. I mean, you mean 20,000-30,000 quid just to promote one song. It's a lot cheaper here in England. And he had an artist he wanted promoted in England. So I did a deal with him. I would promote his artist and he would promote my song. And there you go. He said about his work. And the following week, I had an email on a Wednesday morning saying it was number 35 in the charts. And up it climbed week by week. At one point, I was in the when I was number five, I think number four was Justin Bieber and number six was Harry Styles. I thought it was hilarious because I thought they clearly have no idea, these Americans, how old I am. So that was quite funny. Yeah, and then one morning it went to number one and there it stayed for 4 weeks. So, yeah, quite a journey.
God, that is epic. And it's truly a story of perseverance and also proof that radio ain't dead. So I love it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not dead.
Super powerful. Yeah. And moving on to the music now, how would you describe your style?
That's such a difficult question. I mean, it's kind of middle of the road, pop, soft rock. I was called in a music magazine here when my first album came out, the British Billy Joel. So maybe that tells you something. I don't know.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, it definitely does. Definitely does.
I'll take that. I'm a huge Billy Joel fan. So yeah, all day long.
Well, that sort of answers my next question. You know, what other artists do you look up to? Where do you get inspiration from? What's the process about writing your songs?
I kind of love that kind of 70s vibe. That's been said about my music, the West Coast kind of thing. I know Billy Joel's an East Coast artist, but if you think of like Steely Dan or Fleetwood Mac, Eagles, you know, that kind of polished kind of soft rock thing. I'm a huge Paul McCartney fan as well. He's the reason I ever wanted to play the guitar or play the piano and write songs, going back all the way back to those days, listening to those Beatles cassettes with my mum and dad. Inspiration can come from anywhere, really. I think having lived a proper job and done a proper job and lived a real life during that period in my 20s and early 30s when I was working in the building industry with my dad gives you a proper grounding and a real life, you know, rather than just, you know, say I was 18 and I'd won the X Factor or something. Mm-hmm. And you get taken away on this incredible journey, but perhaps you don't realize, you know, the nuances and the struggles of everyday life. So, you know, I've been there. I'm still there, really. You know what I mean? You don't make much money these days as even an American number one. So there's a grounding which brings a reality to the songs. I think people can relate to that. So that's probably helped me.
Yeah. But, you know, it's still exciting as well. You know, you're getting the bubbles, you're getting the pizzing and the pizzang. You've also, I believe, worked with some quite big influential people. Do you want to do a bit of name dropping?
Well, I mentioned Paul McCartney. So, I mean, I was lucky enough to meet and hang out with Paul McCartney for a few days back in 2012, I think it was, 2012, 2013. It was at the Queen's Jubilee concert, no less, in Buckingham Palace. And I was actually there working with Cliff Richard. But all the stars were there, Elton John, Ed Sheeran, Stevie Wonder, Kylie, Robbie, I don't know, just everyone who was anyone was there if you saw the concert. And so I latched on to Paul McCartney pretty quickly because he's my hero. And I followed him around like a lost puppy, I think, for 3 days. But he was very gracious and humble with it. And so that was a real thrill.
And they say don't meet your heroes, but that wasn't your experience, no?
Not at all. He was a real gentleman and very, very down to earth and everything I wanted him to be. So that was lovely. But yeah, so I mean, I've worked with a lot of people. I worked with Glenn Frey I mentioned the Eagles as one of my influences. Glenn Frey, I worked with him on his last solo album a couple of years before he passed away. But I've worked with Mark Knopfler and all sorts of people.
And working with them in what capacity?
In capacity of, I run the promotions business. I promoted their music. I have performed with some of them. And recorded with some of them, so all sorts of things, and that's all in the last 10 years since I made that dive and took that kind of fork in the road towards the music business. I've been very, very fortunate with the people that I've managed to hang. I've met my heroes. You know, I mean, what could be better? You know, I'm living the dream.
It's super cool. It's super cool. Living the dream. You know, making music at home and in your studio, or how often do you get out and do concerts, live tours? Do you have, you know, the experience of being on the stage?
Yeah, I love that. When my first album came out, I did a lot of touring. I toured with Leo Sayer for a couple of months. I was the support act here in England. I toured with Tapao. I was in the band Tapao as well. So I did the support act kind of thing. And then I had to come off stage for 10 minutes, had a quick beer, changed my T-shirt and went back on and played percussion and did backing singing with them. I toured with Beverly Craven, the Hollies, Dean Friedman, the American artist. So I did all that. And then COVID came along and kind of put a stop to all that, all those kind of shenanigans. And it's I've got a band. I've got a band last year and we've started going out and playing a few more gigs. So, I still love doing that. My favourite place to be is here in my studio, writing and creating. But it's nice to get out and play on the road every now and then.
Fair enough. That's a fair point of view. And how's your family reacted to all of this as well? Like you say, you've taken them on a curveball with your decisions.
Yeah. I mean, the kids are grown up now. Not grown up, they're still living here. But
I mean, that's the story of life these days.
Yeah, the youngest is 18 now. They're obviously 18, 21 and 24. They were a lot younger, obviously, when I took that plunge. No, I think they're very, very proud of me. Yes. I mean, I think there was a time they go through that certain age when they're perhaps, I don't know, 12 or 13, when they wouldn't be seen dead with their dad, or the fact that I'd get up and sing in front of people is like the worst thing in the world. But now they come to all my gigs and come with all their friends, and all their friends know me, and they listen to me, and they all say, "Oh, we love that new track," or whatever, all his mates and all their mates and all that. So it's very nice. We're all very close.
And is there anything that you can do with any of them? Have any of them got the music bug?
My middle son, Sam, has got a good voice. He's a good singer and he plays a bit of piano. Maybe one day. The other two aren't interested in it. I think they're not, they don't like the spotlight so much. They'd rather hide behind me. But yeah, Sam's a show off. So he may follow in my footsteps eventually.
We'll see. And of course, so you're launching this song and a new album. Go for it. Tell us all about it.
Well, this is a standalone single, actually. It's a song called The Greatest Thing, and it's actually 1+1 featuring Michael Armstrong as opposed to just Michael Armstrong, and that's because I wrote it with my friend Warren Bennett, who actually produced my second album back in 2018, and we've stayed good mates. Wrote a whole lot of songs together during lockdown, which were never intended for me to sing. We were kind of doing a publishing idea. A lot of them were written for female singers. We were chatting last year and I said to him, you know, we should do something with these songs. And, you know, I always thought this particular one would work well for my voice. And it was it's just an out and out pop song. It's a love song. There's nothing clever about it. It's just, you know, 3.5 minute, happy, feel good pop song.
I was arguing with a listener last week because I put a lot of meanings behind things. You know, we have a section in the show called Philosophize This, and he was like, when's a song just going to be a song? And I was like, no, music is art. It's always got a deeper meaning behind it. But here you are saying it's just a song.
This one is. My albums are a bit singer-songwritery, and you got to decipher perhaps, you know, a bit, certainly when I was younger as well, you got to decipher it. But this was an exercise. Warren and I wrote during lockdown. I say we're going to write for other people. We're just going to write simple, out and out pop songs. Nothing clever. That was my remit, and this is one of the songs that we came up with, and it will be on an album. I said it was 10 years since my first album came out, so in June we're releasing a kind of retrospective. I would say greatest hits, but that might be pushing it a little bit. A kind of retrospective collection of some singles, album tracks and rarities, and this track is going to be on it, so that's cool.
Oh, well, fantastic. We're going to play it out now, let the listeners decide for themselves what their thoughts on it are, and they can also get in touch and let us know their thoughts. It can be found on Spotify. Is there anywhere else that you'd like people to look it up, or about any upcoming gigs that you'd like to promote if people have been captured by all this?
Okay, well, the best place to go is my website, which is michaelarmstrongmusic.co.uk. And you can hear all the albums on there, watch all the videos, see lots of photographs of me with all the famous people I mentioned. And yeah, it's a pretty cool website, so check it out.
Absolutely. And here is The Greatest Thing by 1+1 featuring Michael Armstrong himself.
In the morning, The great